very important. It's not a scroll, but it is a mini booklet, so I can keep myself focused here. Okay, now I'm a little nervous. Okay, so the whole way up here, I was talking about Spirit, give me the words that other people need to hear, right? So I've been asking that for that this entire week, actually preparing for this. And so I wrote down some things because I want to really... So, first of all, this is because my little stuffed animal is so that I can stay grounded. When I get scared, my little girl wants to run and dissociate. And dissociation is a really easy thing for me to do. So my therapist suggested that I get something to help me. And so tactile, fuzzy stuffed animals do that for me. I want to talk a little bit about, I kind of subscribe to the, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'm going to focus on that, but I'm also going to talk about how scary it is to break the don't talk, don't trust, don't feel rules, and the ways that those rules have shown up in my family of origin and in my life, and why this is so important for me to do this tonight, because I'm breaking those rules. So I grew up, I'm a middle child. I grew up about an hour or so south of here. My parents were high school sweethearts. They got married young. They were around, you know, early 20s or so when they got married. And they were both looking to escape a crappy family life. My dad's family was very rigid, incredibly controlling, and very punishing. He was Italian, you know, very Catholic, military on that side, the whole thing. So they were, in my mind, they were the don't feel. You didn't talk, you know, if they had a fight, they didn't talk to each other. I mean, a lot of people in my family still don't talk to each other on that side. And my mom's side of the family, my mom was young. My grandpa passed away, her dad, when she was 5. And my grandma stopped talking about my grandpa. And my mom didn't understand it. She wanted to know my dad. She wanted to know about him because she had such small memories of him. So she learned really early not to talk about it. You don't talk about things. If you ask grandma or if you ask mom about what's going on, she won't tell you. You just accept that she's not going to say anything. So that was the side of the don't talk, don't trust. And I learned that really well. So, and my mom's side of the family was, this is an interesting dichotomy, I find this in my life a lot. My dad's side of the family was the drinking, you know, I have the grandparents that were, you know, giving my brother alcohol when they were getting together for family functions and stuff, and my brother was really little, and my mom's side of the family is this teetotaling, really religious, like, so it's interesting, I have some strange combination of mixed messages from the very beginning. My parents fought all the time. They fought in front of us. I'm the middle. My sister is 14 months older than me. My brother is younger, so we were all born really close together. My sister was born in 1980. I was born in 81. My brother was born in 82. So I think having that stress probably on my parents, they were fighting constantly. They fought about money. They fought about us. They fought about stuff around the house. They were just fighting. My dad was learning kind of the family business and sort of looking to impress his parents. He had definitely had some issues where he was trying to appease his mom, make sure that everybody knew who he was. And so he put his parents before his own family, which caused a lot of issues in my parents' marriage. My dad was a workaholic. He would go to work before, a lot of times before we would even go to school, he would leave. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom for a long time until we were in high school. And when my parents divorced, she went back to work. So my dad was running the family business. He was gone weekends. He was gone, you know, he would leave at 5:45 or something, and then he wouldn't get home until sometimes 8:00. He was always on the phone. It was attached to him always. So he was really emotionally unavailable and physically unavailable. He was never around. And if he was around, He was either sitting in his chair, barking at us, or he was griping about something that my mom said or something that we did or didn't do. I mean, he was just, it was really a miserable situation to be in. My sister, the way she dealt with it, she mentally checked out. She found distraction in various things that allowed her to just kind of, she was there physically, but she was really unaware of what was going on. My brother physically checked out, so he had friends, he would go visit them all the time, and he was hardly ever home, and so that was his method of coping. We would do lots of things with my mom because we knew that Dad wasn't safe and wasn't fun to be around, so she would come up with, especially towards the end of their marriage and when things got really bad, she would come up with things for us to do, and so we would just go, whatever it was. It was like, you know, Dad would come home and it was like we were gone. We all vanished like, you know, cockroaches scattering. It was, so that's how I lived life. I took on the hero role. I was made to be my mom's confidant. I knew what my parents' marriage was like early on. I knew that they were having problems. I knew that she was unhappy. I saw that she was depressed. And I thought that I was supposed to fix it. I thought that I was responsible for her feelings. I thought that nobody else was around, right? I mean, sisters checked out, brothers checked out, Dad's clueless. So I'm the only one that's seeing this, right? I'm the only one that notices that she has feelings that she doesn't know how to handle. So I took on her stuff. I tried to be perfect. I tried to be the peacemaker. I tried to hold it all together for everybody else. In the meantime, I got completely lost. I was the overachiever, got really good grades in school. You know, the fixer, the people pleaser, always looking for harmony. I was always kind of like the mediator between everybody. Like, you know, even still, I have this ability to kind of figure out what two sides of the argument is, what people are saying, and be able to kind of interpret for people. And I still do that. Now I actually use it for good rather than... but I'm still doing that. I find that's still, you know, it's difficult for me to... But that part I've discovered is a gift. So kind of the bottom line in that scenario was that I feared my dad. He was angry. You know, we were children of the belt. My mom carried a paddle in her purse, broke a couple on us, and my dad chased us around the house with, I mean, leather belt. I still know the sound of that, the snap that it sounds like. So, you know, but to the outside world, we were normal family. You know, my dad was very into making sure that everybody thought we were a good family, keeping up appearances. You know, he knew a lot of people in town. Town was small. A lot of people, you know, my parents grew up there, my grandparents grew up there. So it was important for him to make sure that he didn't embarrass anybody, you know, or he didn't look a certain way because that was, you know, not what was expected of him. And, you know, so there were no boundaries in my family. It was really, it was kind of a free-for-all at home. I was talking to my therapist about this today. You know, anybody could walk into your room, anybody could whatever. My dad I had really bad acne. It was, you know, one of the things that I inherited, lucky for me. My dad used to pick at my face. He used to hold me down and try to get to my acne and try to, you know, get rid of it because I didn't fit the mold of perfect. I didn't look to everybody else the way he wanted me to look. So I received that message very loud and clear that I wasn't okay the way I was. So I remember looking at some pictures. My grandma passed away in December. And there were these photos of me. And I remember the clothes that I was in. I don't remember anything about the circumstances that the photos were taken. And it dawned on me that my portion of trying to make sense of the crazy family life was that I sought control over my own appearance, but not necessarily my physical body, but my clothes. I was really particular, even when I was little, about what my clothes looked like, making sure that they were clean and tidy, even when I was like really little. So I discovered that that's something that I've done from a very early age. And so, you know, looking at how I still try to control things, and do I? And so that's been a big, big part of my recovery. This is an interesting experience. I was talking about staying, not dissociating, and so I'm feeling a moment of like, okay, I'm going to escape for a second. No, no, I'm going to stay here. Okay. I want to be present with you all. So that's why notes are handy, so I can keep track of where I'm at. There was no real physical expression of love or care in my family. My dad did this sort of like one-armed hug thing when people were around, like, okay, you're my kid, we love each other, we're all going to hang out together, you know, like, we're good. And it was like, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, you know. It was like, I don't know you, I don't want to, you know, spend any time with you. It's like, it was a very interesting, my mom, I will say, was probably the more nurturing of the two, but she definitely had some difficulties. I'm not sure if both my parents were narcissists or if it's just my dad, but they definitely had their own stuff. They weren't able to really look at what was going on with their kids. So I turned that all inward. I had stomach problems very early. I didn't ever feel safe inside the house. I was constantly... Sorry, that's not for me. I was constantly hypervigilant, looking for a way to be safe because I never knew when my parents were going to start fighting, or, you know, things. My dad was going to come looking for me to deal with my skin. So I learned really early that two-leggeds weren't safe, but four-leggeds were safe for me. My parents had English Springer Spaniels before they had any children, so Muffin was our first dog, and she was the sweetest thing that would let us lay on her and hang out with her and tug on her ears when we were little. So I spent a lot of time in the backyard crying and talking to the dogs, realizing now that, you know, I was definitely a depressed little kid, and that was the only thing that felt safe for me, was their unconditional love, because they empathized, you know. So I completely, at school, I was very internal. I went to Catholic school for 10 years, since second grade through 12th grade, and I was afraid to move. I was afraid to be seen, so this is huge for me. I was afraid to be heard, and I was afraid to screw something up. So when I got to second grade, and I transferred to a Catholic school, I earned myself the nickname Mute because people thought that I couldn't talk. But I was so scared and literally afraid to move that I just didn't say anything to anybody. I developed a really strong sort of fantasy imagination kind of world. And that was safe for me because then that way I could make the story fit what I wanted it to fit. That later came to bite me in the butt, but I'll talk about that later. So I was literally afraid of everything and everyone. I remember having, you know, we had to go to church with our classmates and stuff, and I was terrified that I was going to do something that people were going to notice in a group of people, you know? My dad was the drinker and the rager. He was violent with my mom a couple of times, and I did witness some of it. My mom finally decided to kick my dad out of the house when he slapped my brother across the face, which I also witnessed, because he wouldn't clean his room. So my mom kicked him out, and my mind does not catalog time the way I think it's the trauma, but anyways, they finally divorced sometime when I was in high school. They had a 2-year court-ordered, you know, visitations, court-ordered mediation, court-ordered therapy, which none of it helped, and I felt, you know, completely lost. And I didn't talk to my dad for a really long time after that. He constantly blamed my mother for everything bad in his life, and I didn't want to hear it. And anytime I got together with him, it was, your mom this, your mom that, blah, blah, blah. I'm the victim, yada, yada. So I stopped, you know, it wasn't about my relationship with him, it was about his resentment towards my mom. And so I stopped, he was toxic for me, and I stopped talking to him for a long time. So that sort of covers what it was like. What happened is that, so toward the end of my parents' marriage, my parents met a man and his girlfriend or wife. My mom used to collect antiques, so she would go to estate sales and auctions and stuff, and she would buy antiques. And when we were little, we even had one of those old phones where you talk into the stand and you hold the other part up to, and it worked. It was fun to play with. But my mom had all of these antiques, and so we went, you know, they would go to auctions and estate sales and stuff. Both my parents, this was really when things completely started crumbling, and I'd go with my mom and stuff, and, you know, I kind of developed an appreciation for old things, and I understood her fascination with them. And so one of the auctions, my dad offered to haul some furniture for this person and his girlfriend, wife, whatever, ex-wife. So they became really good friends with the family. He was a therapist, not our therapist, but he was a therapist. And when my mom decided to file for divorce, he was there. You know, he was like, here's a woman about to be a single mom now, basically, because she was still continuing to raise us. And she did everything around the house anyways. So I'm sure he, you know, wanted to be there to support us and do all of that stuff. And so in the beginning, it started out that way, that we would go and we would talk to him, and, you know, he would kind of listen to what was going on with us. He'd worked with kids through therapy, and he actually had his own business for, he was an MFT for drug and alcohol problems in adolescents and kids. And he had been in AA for, I think at the time, somewhere around 14 years or something like that. So we spent a lot of time talking to them, him and his girlfriend, playing games, riding bikes, you know, swimming, doing a bunch of stuff outside of, and just, you know, I felt listened to. I felt paid attention to. And it was great because I was like, oh, good, I get to go away from my family and talk about them and talk about what I'm feeling. Because at home, I felt like, you know, they all thought I was crazy. I'm pretty sure they thought I was nutty. I was, you know, very different thinking than a lot of them. And so, I remember one time I actually hid in the closet wondering if my parents would go looking for me, because I, you know, it was so chaotic, and I thought, all right, nobody's going to come looking for me. It'll be 10 minutes. They'll come. Somebody will show up. Somebody will realize I'm, you know, not in the scene of everything else, and nobody ever did. So I think that definitely played a part in that need for feeling listened to, feeling heard. So it's kind of great actually having a captive audience to be able to own my own story, and being heard and seen and felt. So this person, after some time, started to be sexually suggestive with me. So I was 11 or so, I think. So for about a year, I was able to keep him away, keep him at a distance. And around 12 years old, I guess I gave up. I don't know. I don't know if I didn't have the energy or if I was brainwashed enough to think that, I really did think he cared about me. So he essentially started grooming me to be his sex toy, for lack of a better way to put it. And I was there solely to act out his fantasies. So I became, because I thought he loved me, I became a people pleaser for him. I lost myself. I did everything. I was the chameleon. I'm going to, you know, be the perfect person, and he's going to care about me. And, you know, he would punish me by not talking to me. So, of course, then that made me go, what can I do to fix this? How can I bring you back into my life? Because I thought he was the only person that heard me and saw me. So I had, I had 6 years of brainwashing, basically, until I was 18. I had no self-worth, no self-esteem. I basically was walking around like an empty shell. I didn't know who I was. I never knew who I was to begin with. And then, you know, having something like that happen in formative years when you're supposed to be being social and making friends and doing all of this stuff was really difficult for me. And I was made to, sort of interesting that he lived near where Charles Manson did as well, because he was very much into the brainwashing stuff. And I was taught to accept things that were taboo. You know, his fantasies, his fetishes, his whatever, I was meant to accept them. I mentioned he had a girlfriend or ex-wife, and she was a victim of his at one point, and then became a victimizer, a co-perpetrator with him. So she was involved in all of this stuff too, and I covered it up. I remember at one point my mom asking me, I had gone for a walk to go talk with him, and I came back and took my jacket off, and my shirt was up above my bra, and I didn't notice it. And she asked me about it, and I covered it up because he told me if people find out about it, they're going to take me away. So I covered it up. I was, in that same time frame, constantly compared to other girls by him. In front of, you know, so he sees somebody and he would physically compare me to that person. So talk about not having any self-esteem. And so I completely lost myself. I lost all pieces of myself. I was so fragmented and so scattered, I didn't know what to do with myself. I got more depressed. I actually moved in with them right after high school. He managed to put a wedge between my mom and me. And so I really didn't have anybody else to depend on except for him. I had thoughts of suicide a lot. Didn't do it because I knew how upset my mom would be. But I had several plans many times. So I went to live with them. I got a job down there because she told me if I wanted to stay there, then I had to get a job. So I got a job. They dropped me off in the middle of the valley. I was 17 or something and didn't know anything, didn't have a cell phone, didn't have a car, and said, don't come back until you've got a job interview, and I was scared to death. While I was at that job, this was my second, right after the second year of college, I went back there, moved back in with them for the summer, and started going back to work at the job that I had gotten when I was there. And this man came in and started talking to me like he kind of knew me. I was like, he knew my favorite colors. He somehow knew this situation, not in all the detail, but knew that somebody was controlling me and knew that I was in an unsafe place. So I actually, I don't know what made me do this, but I actually got in the car with him. Told you I was like a shell of a person. So I got in the car with this person I didn't know. He was of an ethnicity that he wasn't able to be seen with me. So I got in his car and he talked to me, and for some reason I started listening to what he was saying, and it started to kind of click what situation I was in. my friend who was supposed to go and meet with me. So I had isolated, really, because nobody understood what the hell I was going through. Who could, right? So I was supposed to meet with a friend of mine, but she flaked. And so I called my mom up, and I asked her if I could meet with her. And she said, yeah, of course. And I hadn't talked to her in a long time. And so we got together for lunch, and the entire story came out. And she said, well, we're getting you the hell out of there. So she drove me down to their house, and we took everything that I could think of that was mine out of there and left, and I moved in with her. And then in November, the following November, I filed a police report. So, now I was in college when all of this stuff was going on in terms of the court system and all of that stuff. And I actually put myself through school for the most part all by myself. I took out my own student loans. I took out, went to an all-women's college because it was safe for me, and it was actually a really good thing. It was up in the Bay Area, and it was fantastic. And I got to do art, which I love. I got to have my own studio space, and it was sort of my little sanctuary. Like, art's a meditation for me. So I filed a police report, and my junior year of college, they were both sentenced. He got 99 years to life, and she got 6 years, and now she has to register as a sex offender. So both of the things that they were both completely afraid of happened to them. And I found out later that I helped save some other girls, which is pretty cool. So for the next 10 years, I basically isolated. I was like, I don't try to get my crap together. I don't know how to do that. You know, I went through some therapy. I explored modalities in terms of spirituality and metaphysics. And I got really enmeshed with my mom. If I wasn't before, I really was then, because she wanted to help protect me. And so I went headfirst into a codependent relationship with her. And then I got involved with a relationship, romantic relationship-wise, with somebody that I worked for. He was my boss. And the short version of that story is that it got me into Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous about 6 or 7 years ago. I realized in that program that I'm driven by love, the need for love, the desire to be heard and seen in a way that I couldn't get anywhere else until I started coming into these meetings. I've gone into that relationship knowing I wasn't supposed to be in that relationship. And I felt guilty for being with this person. So we had to hide it because he was my boss. My mom found out at some point. She freaked out. She actually threatened him. And so then we completely hid the whole thing. And I started to get to the place after, that was 2.5 years of being in relationship with him, I started to get to the place of feeling like there was no way out for me because I wasn't able to end it. And I started, the suicidal ideation started to come back. I started to think about, you know, harming myself and cutting myself, and I realized that I needed to get help. So I went to therapy. I was actually working up here in Santa Barbara at the time. And my therapist knew about love addiction, and she said, you should check out this book. And it was one of the primary, and so I read it, or started reading it, and I was like, I don't understand, what is she getting at? Like, I really didn't get it. And so it took me a while, but I finally started getting on some of the phone calls and stuff and started getting a sponsor. And my SLAA sponsor, I would talk to her every week. I've never actually met her. I met her on the phone lines, and she's on the East Coast. So I would call her religiously every week, and we would work the steps on the phone, and we would work through. And then she goes, well, but everything that you're talking about is stuff related to your family of origin. maybe you should check out ACA. And I was like, what's ACA? You know, she had been in 30 years or so of 12 steps. She was a therapist herself. And she said, I think that what's really going on underneath your love addiction is your ACA stuff. Okay, maybe she's got a point. Let's check this out. So I like to say I got kicked out of my first ACA meeting. I went to an OHI meeting, which was a closed meeting, and it was posted on the website. So I thought, closed meeting means you identify as an ACA, right? I definitely identify as an ACA. I'm going to go to this meeting. So at the time, I was living in Santa Paula, and I drove up to OHI. I made the trek. I get there. You can't stay. What do you mean I can't stay? You can't stay. They had a group conscience, and they decided that I could not stay. So I turned around, got in my car, drove back to Santa Paula, cried the entire time, cried some more when I got home, called my SLAA sponsor and told her what happened, freaked out, called a bunch of other people that I knew in recovery. Sometime after that, came back to another ACA meeting where I got to stay. I don't know when that was. Had to have been at least 4 years ago. It's probably been longer than that. But like I said, my mind doesn't catalog time very well. So the other thing I really want to talk about, because it's had a huge impact in my life, has been my mom. I lost my mom 2.5 years ago to breast cancer. And so September 8th, 2015, my mom was my rock. In a lot of ways, she was so strong and so inspirational. And since she passed, now I've moved through step four, and I started looking at my relationship with her and her, you know, what did she pass on to me? She passed on to me some great things. She passed on to me, you know, I'm not an extrovert, but I'm really a lot like her in terms of how she's able to connect with people. And so she passed on some really good things to me. But what she also passed on to me, and like I said earlier, her side of the family was the don't talk, don't trust side of the family for me. She had breast cancer for 1.5 years before she told anybody. She didn't want to be a burden. She didn't want to make things difficult for her 3 kids. She didn't want to, you know, she was the martyr. She really was. And not in a good way in this instance, because by the time we all found out that she was so sick, and she actually covered it up. I asked her, you know, are you okay? Why is your arm all swollen? And she said, oh, I fell. And then, okay, but next week, her arm's still swollen. Well, she had lymphedema in her arm, but she didn't tell anybody what was really going on. And she, by the time she got to the hospital, she drove herself to the urgent care. She had a collapsed lung. The doctor basically said she was breathing out of the equivalent of breathing out of a straw. So she drove herself to the urgent care. They took her immediately, and she got an ambulance ride to the hospital. Meanwhile, I was trying to convince her that I could get her financial stuff so she wouldn't have to worry about anything, which is the only reason why she went to the urgent care that day. So then they took care of her collapsed lung. She had a double mastectomy. She had radiation, and she had chemo. And then it went to her brain, so she had brain surgery. They got all of that, and then it went to her stomach, and she passed away from it. September 8th, 2015. And my mom, that night, she did things the way she wanted to do them. And we were all there the night that she passed away. And so right after, you know, we were like, okay, Mom, I love you. I'll see you tomorrow. And then right after visiting hours, about an hour or so, I got a phone call that she had passed away. So, yeah, it's been... I'm so grateful. I remember being in meetings. I was going to some of the OHI meetings at the time and just going in and crying. And I wasn't able to speak. I wasn't able to do anything. All I could do was cry. So I'm so grateful to have people in program. My mom didn't really know that I was in ACA. But I know she would have been really proud of me to be up here tonight. So, So what it's like now. Gosh, so many good things have happened since I came into this program. Aside from getting up here and talking to you people, which, like, literally, I was the behind-the-scenes person. When I was in grade school, everybody's like, yeah, we're going to do the school play, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, no. I'm going to do the set. How about that? And they're like, well, all the parents are doing the sets, right? Okay, why can't I do it? It was fifth grade. I want to do the set. So they let me design the set for our school play. art's really my passion. I've lately been in this kind of obsessive compulsive. I love these. I've been coloring. I've been doing these mandalas. Normally I do, like, you know, the critical parent will come in, but I will do these really photorealistic, sort of hyperrealistic soft pastel pieces, landscapes. And lately I'm like, that's too much pressure. I'm just going to do something that feels fun. And so my little kid likes to color. So I have a ton of Sharpies and other markers that I just sit kind of obsessively just because I want to see how they turn out. You know, I want to pick different color selections and then I want to see how it goes. And I feel like that's sort of where my life's at right now. Like, I want to see where it goes. I want to see how it turns out. And that's huge for me because that's, you know, that's not depression. That's not giving myself away. That's not any of the things that I came out of. I don't isolate anymore. I have friends in recovery. I have wonderful relationships with people. I still have recovery partners that I talk to that I've, again, never met from my SLAA. And I've had them for years. I have play in my life, and I'm learning to have more balance in my life as well. I work ACA in every area of my life, including taking it to work, especially taking it to work. I'm an office manager of a company that is fairly, it's kind of at that place of, like, you know, make it or break it sort of startup company and a little bit bigger. And so me as the good ACA in the hero role, I went in there all like, I'm going to fix everything, I'm going to do everything, and I did. And now I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore. I didn't want to do that to begin with. So I'm letting other people, you know, do their jobs. I'm doing my job, staying focused, you know, on myself, turning perfectionism over to spirit on a regular basis. Having a great relationship with my higher power now. I didn't get Catholicism at all. I was like, why are we sitting, standing, kneeling? What is happening? I don't get this. and I've always kind of had this, like, sort of different bend on life anyways. I've had this kind of, you know, I got into metaphysics and all of this other stuff. You know, I have crystals in my room and I have all this other stuff that I really, you know, really related to, and so I've done a lot of other kind of exploration around that. And I was, as I was driving here tonight and I got off the freeway, I was like, there's a goose. I gotta look up goose. So I looked up goose, and I was so excited to hear about what it was talking about. It was really talking about exactly this, about talking, about loyalty to your group, and since you guys are all my family, I was like, you know. And about that aspect of your spirit, that your soul that wants to be that light in the world, which I feel like, not in an egotistical way, but that's where I feel like my path is. So I still do therapy every week. I just had that, like I said, I had therapy this morning, which is awesome. I'm working on PTSD recovery with my therapist, and I'm also working on, no surprise here, body image issues. So I've been working on that. And she's been great. I learned that part of my self-care, and in SLAA they call them top lines. I do better at it sometimes than I do other times, but you know, I struggle with food and eating good, healthy things. I have ulcerative colitis. That's one of the things that came out of that whole, you know, stressful childhood, I think. And I don't always eat the way I'm supposed to for it. So, you know, I'm still struggling with that. I'm not saying everything's, you know, unicorns and rainbows, but but I'm doing better. I managed through my own realization that I needed to be on a low dose of antidepressant, which has been a big thing for me because I resisted it, but watching the fact that it runs in my family and knowing that I can see it's changed me, I actually feel present when I'm on it, which is crazy, but it's an interesting experience. So that's been a part of my self-care. I'm less self-punitive, for sure. Way more trusting about what's going to happen in the world and in my life. You know, before, like I said, I was afraid to move. Now it's like, okay, you know, I can get involved in something. People can see me. It's all right. I don't have to be so afraid. I'm working on step 8 now. So, yes, my sponsor has told me to put myself at the top of the list, so that will be the first letter I write. I'm embracing all of my feelings now, including the anger and the grief. So I used to be one of those people that, like, when I would go to a meeting, that was my moment of to actually feel things. But any other time, I wasn't dealing with what was going on in my feeling state. So as soon as I got into a meeting, I was like, you know, it would all come out, everything. Now it's sort of flip-flopped, you know, I still have to focus on work, I still have to live my life, but I know when I need to let something out. I need to cry on my way home, or I need to whatever, and I've got people to turn to that I can call and talk about it. I remember a friend of mine, she found out some of my story and the abuse that happened to me, and she was like, why aren't you mad? How come you're not mad? Like, you should be, I'm pissed for you. Why aren't you pissed? I couldn't ever get to that place. I don't know why. Now I recognize that that's okay. I've accepted it. And I do, there is still some anger there, but I kind of feel like there's a part of my, it's a part of my soul that just knowing that I put him in jail and that he can't hurt anybody else gives me, that's enough for me, you know. I'm adulting now and getting pretty good at it. I don't take my little girl to work. I leave my inner child at home to play with the dog. I don't throw her in front of my boss to try to deal with life. I'm not hiding. I'm standing up for myself. My boss used to be a huge authority figure for me, and now she's just a person, which is fantastic. I believe in myself more. I'm trusting myself more, and I'm believing in the process. I've learned that I can have discernment. You know, I see boundaries now. The strongest way that my higher power talks to me is through my intuition. And I listen to it now. Before, I was like, no, I'm just going to ignore that because I assumed that everybody else knew what was good for me. I reach out to fellow travelers on a regular basis, at least a few times a week. I'm going to 2 meetings now. Embracing more of the unknown and learning to reparent myself. I'm learning to be me. Actually, I didn't even know before coming into these rooms what that was. I kind of had a sense, but I wasn't exactly sure. You know, I had pieces of this and pieces of that, but nothing that really felt cohesive. And now coming into the program, I realized that I've actually started to put the pieces back to wholeness, and I'm not fragmented. I'm learning to be honest and authentic, and the don't feel part has definitely not taken hold of me anymore. I learned that one of my greatest strengths is actually my vulnerability. You know, if I can go into a meeting and be honest and not care what anybody thinks and not care about how it comes out, that's huge for me. So I'm going to meetings. I started a meeting in Camarillo in October last year, and that's going really well. Service is huge for me. It has been really big for me because I realized that I wanted a meeting, and if I didn't help keep the doors open, there may not be a meeting for me. And I knew I needed that. You know, I have a superficial relationship with my dad now. It was kind of a sort of a reconciliation, I guess. right after my mom passed away, But I still, you know, my family still has no boundaries. And I saw him today and I was like, I need to continue to have a meeting where I can process this stuff. I'm on the committee for Camp Recovery because I love it. I had no friends, and my therapist said, maybe you should go try it, check it out. And I went in there, and the first time I went there, I was like, these are my tribe. This is my people, you know? Like, this is so, like, the warm, fuzzy thing. I was like, okay, I'm hooked. I have been, and actually I'm sad that George is in here because she was doing some of the Promise 7 events when I started kind of really getting into recovery, and I remember meeting her and going to some of those, and it was so wonderful. It was like such a, my little kid was so excited to meet people that wanted to go do fun things. And so then I started with another fellow traveler. We started putting some of the Promise 7 events together. And I don't want to embarrass anybody, but thank you. And I live in the present. I accept whatever it is that God has in store for me. You know, when Teresa asked me to do this, it took me a couple of days to go, okay, I think it's time, but I don't know. And when George first started doing these meetings, I was like, she said, what about you? And I went, not yet. No, not ready for that yet. But I trust that now is the time for me, you know, and what a great person to share the meeting with. So continuing to work on loving my physical body more, which has been difficult. I find that I have a tendency to kind of punish myself unconsciously with some of the things I say to myself and the food that I eat. And I'm learning to connect with my inner child. I was just having a conversation the other night after the meeting about my little kid. I know when I'm my true self, when my little girl is excited to do something. You know, for one of the Promise 7 events, we went to the zoo, and my little kid was so excited. She was like, I want to see the lion. I want to do this. I want to do that. And I was like, wait, I'm supposed to be in charge of this whole thing, right? I don't care. I want to go play. You know, and it sort of snowballed into this whole other thing. Now I'm like doing face painting and all of this fun stuff. It's been really fantastic, and I'm learning to incorporate my critical parent into my journey. Instead of tossing her off the bus and go, screw that, I'm not listening to you anymore. I'm actually going, okay, thank you for your help with that. I appreciate the love and the protection that you provided. That doesn't work. How do you feel about being a part of this next step? And so that's where I'm at right now with my critical parent. I think almost every single one of those promises has shown up in my life at some point in time and continue to. Continuing to thrive, not just survive, because I felt like life was a survival for such a long time. And the realization the last couple of days about, I'm really excited to see how my life ends up. Like one of those mandalas, like what colors, what does it look like when I get to finish it? That's huge for me. So, and being up here and sharing my story has been really huge. So thank you all for being a captive audience.